Thank you, Lantham. So it's a great pleasure to be giving this colloquium at Parameter. Of course, I've had a long association with Parameter as a DVRC, and hopefully we'll get back to that mode where we are giving seminars in person, and we'll be able to visit again, give a talk with holding the famous hockey stick. But for now, you'll have to make do with my Zoom, with our, limited Zoom resources. If you have questions during the talk, feel free to ask me. And in case those questions are require a more in-depth discussion, I'll just defer it to the end. All right, so let's get started. So the topic today, which was suggested to me, was to talk a bit more about these Moray lattices and the interesting physics that is experimentally and observed and theoretically expected in these situations. I believe you already heard a talk recently by Pablo, one of the key experimentalists in this area. But I'll try to give you more of a theorist's view to this. In particular, I'd like to connect it with some sort of broad themes in condensed matter physics and more generally in theoretical physics. Okay, so the hero of the story is, as it often happens in condensed matter, is a very humble kind of system. It's this literally a lump of coal, if you like. You have these sheets of graphene that you can isolate. And over the years, people have gotten very good at putting them together, putting contacts on them, and seeing what happens. And we'll see, despite being such a simple system, sort of in the best traditions of condensed matter physics, there is a very exciting and unusual phenomena that are observed, magnetism, superconductivity, and all kinds of topological phenomena. Are seen in these Moray lattices. Okay, so to kind of remind you what we mean by Moray lattice, this is the lattice of graphene. It's just an element, hexagonal honeycomb lattice of carbon atoms. You take a pair of them, stack them on top of each other, and twist. Of course, the trick is to get the angle right. You see this Moray pattern, which is at a larger scale than the atomic lattice. And we're really going to be thinking about electrons moving through this effective lattice. It turns out that this is sort of the key ingredient that triggers new physics in the system. It's really the interaction of electrons with this periodic structure. Okay, so if you go back to the early days of solid state physics, one of the big challenges, and which was successfully overcome, was to understand the distinction between metals and insulators. Okay, some materials are good conductors of electricity, heat, etc. Some are not, and what's the distinction? And ultimately, people understood this has to do with the propagation of electrons through this periodic medium. Okay, the atoms form a periodic structure. The properties of electrons are modified by moving through this periodic medium. And for example, they form these electronic bands, which if you completely fill them, you have an energy gap, and this gives rise to insulators. Okay, and you can think of these insulators as an artificial vacuum, if you like. Just as in the vacuum, you've got to pay certain amount of energy to create a hole, which is sort of the analog of a positron and an electron. Okay, but many of the properties of electrons are significantly modified by the crystalline lattice. And that has actually been of great interest and also has been of great practical value. Okay, so if you think about it, the semiconductor industry, really what we've been trying to do there with semiconductors is to come up with a better vacuum. Okay, so people used to use vacuum tubes in the old days to do logic, to amplify signals and so on. By using electrons and solids, you get to make use of a vacuum with different properties, different effective mass for the electron. For example, a different gap to making holes in electrons and so on. And these distinctions in the quantitative properties can, of course, have huge technological implications, as it happened with the early transistors and solid state versions of things that people were doing before with vacuum tubes. And it's kind of interesting to read the history about this. So there's a book that I recommend, Crystal Fire. So apparently when people did the first demonstration of the transistor, the solid state version of these vacuum tubes, one of the things that was most shocking for people was you didn't have to wait for it to warm up, which is what you had to do with these vacuum tubes. So quite apart from all these effective mass and things like that, just that simple difference from the earlier technology made a big impact on people in the early days. Okay, so these, of course, have been explored for decades now, the fact that semiconductors, for example, can give you quantitatively different properties for electrons. The interesting question that arises is that now that you have this new vacuum, are there also different, qualitatively different properties? Can we say that indeed they are, and these qualitatively new properties, we believe, are actually at the heart of what makes this twisted bilayer graphene rather different and rather special. Okay, so I'll try to give you a pedestrian view of what we mean by these qualitatively new properties of electrons propagating in crystals. Just imagine that you try to write down the semi-classical equations of motion for an electron. If this was propagating the vacuum, you would say that the velocity of the electron, of course, is the gradient in momentum of the kinetic energy. If this was a non-relativistic electron, that would just be your p squared over 2m. The gradient would be the usual relation between momentum and velocity. And this is Newton's equation, the acceleration proportional to the gradient of a potential. Okay, this is what we're used to for electrons in a vacuum, and you can simply generalize it to electrons in a band structure. The dispersion changes, perhaps. But then what, of course, we also know there's another term that's allowed, which is the effect of a magnetic field. You have a Lorentz force, and this is the state of affairs for electrons either in the vacuum or in crystals, except you look at these equations, they look a little bit asymmetrical, right? The momentum equation, there is no counterpart of this Lorentz force in the velocity equation. And in fact, for electrons in a crystal, there is a corresponding term, it turns out. So that is something that is qualitatively new. So you get a new term in the effective equations for an electron that's called an anomalous velocity term. Can you see the anomalous velocity term looks a lot like the Lorentz force, but there's some analog of the magnetic field, the B tilde appearing in those equations. Ken, what does that correspond to? So that turns out to be related to what's called the Berry flux. So this is related to things like the Berry's phase that you learn about in quantum mechanics, except it's in the context of a band structure, the wave functions inside a crystal, how they change as you change the momentum of your electron. This Berry flux, if you like, is related to a certain geometry, a quantum geometry of the wave functions in your electronic band. It's going to play a key role in what we'll talk about. And if you like, the condensed matter physics of the last few decades has really been trying to move away from simply quantitative changes in the properties of electrons to really qualitative changes. And one of the key players has been this quantum geometry of the electronic wave functions. And we'll see that in the context of twisted bilayer graphene, we're going to add interaction effects to this quantum geometry, and that will have interesting consequences. So one of the early consequences that people noticed of this is a connection between geometry and topology, very similar to the kind of connection that you have for the geometry of surfaces. So many years back, Gauss figured out this amazing connection between the topology of two-dimensional surfaces, the number of handles, as you can see over here, let's call that G. Relating that to the curvature of the surface, the intrinsic curvature of the surface. And if you were to integrate this, if you are someone on the surface, like maybe an ant that's exploring this this geometry, can only make local measurements of the curvature. You can still, by integrating this curvature, figure out how many handles your surface has. Okay? And of course, Gauss had many amazing theorems, but he called this, he somehow had a special place for this theorem. He called it his remarkable theorem. And it relates, as you can see, geometry to topology. Okay? And something very similar happens in the context of the band geometry I talked about, the Berry curvature. If you have an entire band which has got this Berry curvature distributed in momentum space, we're thinking of two-dimensional band, you integrate that over all the momenta, it turns out, again, it's going to be an integer times 2 pi, similar to this formula. Some curvature integrated over a manifold gives you an integer times 2 pi. And this turns out to be a topological invariant related to what's called the quantum Hall effect. Okay, so you can measure this topological invariant in a solid simply by measuring a particular kind of resistivity. Okay, so so this was done actually many years back by von Tritzing, who looked at a very particular kind of insulator. So maybe some of us would not call that an insulator per se. It's really electrons exposed to a magnetic field at certain values of the magnetic field, which is commensurate to the density of electrons. So these electrons live in a two-dimensional sample. And what he did was to measure the Hall conductance. Okay, so in contrast to usual measurements of conductance or resistivity, where you run a current down one direction and measure the voltage along the same direction, he measured the voltage in the perpendicular direction. Okay, and you know, following many others in trying to understand a new conductor better. And much to his surprise, he found that these resistivities or these conductances were not any old number that changed with the magnetic field. Instead, they would take on these plateau values, and the plateau values were related to the integers up to some universal constants. Yeah, and if you knew the universal constants, you could compare how accurately the integers were being realized. And in fact, this was being realized one part in a billion. Okay, so extremely accurate quantization. And our modern understanding of this phenomenon is really because of this topological invariant. It's reflecting a topological invariant, which is robust. You cannot change it by a little bit. It's you know, you have a surface with a certain genus, in genus one or genus two, you cannot be somewhere in between. And really that's where the accuracy over here comes from. Okay, and it's sort of amazing to think about because you know, we know of very accurate calculations in physics and people also making measurements very accurately. But the thing we're talking about here is looks something like this. Okay, so the semiconductor in the middle of this figure, it's connected to leads, and people try to make it as clean as they can. But it's still, there is still disorder. You know, this is by no means an ideal system. It's not like measuring some property of an elementary particle to high accuracy. This is really a macroscopic phenomenon in a highly non-ideal system. Okay, yet you see this manifestation of something ideal that emerges when you're in this regime. Okay, so this was in the context of electrons in a magnetic field, but there is a version of this which may be more familiar in terms of the kind of periodic potentials we've been talking about. So you can get the same phenomena in an electronic band. There the analog of this Hall conductance is called the Chern number of the band. Okay, and if you have isolated bands like in an insulator, these bands have to have an integer associated with them, which is the Chern number. Okay, in many instances, this Chern number is simply zero. Under the right conditions, for example, in magnetic materials, you can end up with bands with non-zero Chern number. Okay, and it was demonstrated theoretically that by Thouless and co-workers, the close connection between this Chern number of bands and the quantum Hall effect. And more recently, people have made materials where they've realized this, these theoretical ideas. These are materials where instead of applying a magnetic field, you simply make the material, it's something magnetic, it gets magnetized, and then you go and measure the Hall effect in the absence of a magnetic field, and you see that it has a quantized conductance, just like we saw with the quantum Hall effect. You can make many layers of them, and you get Hall conductance, which is correspondingly multiples of corresponding to the number of layers. Okay, so that is one of the qualitatively new effects that we have begun to explore. Bands that have Berry flux and that have Berry curvature and that have non-trivial Chern number. There's another property that is closely related to this, which has to do with another qualitatively new effect in a band structure. And this actually occurs in graphene. Okay, so in just this two-dimensional sheet of carbon, let's say you had a single sheet. If you examine what the electrons are doing, propagating through the sheet, you find that they have this particular form. This is the energy of the electrons as a function of their momentum. And the natural place to look in this energy diagram is right in the middle, because that's the natural number of electrons that you have in graphene. You fill up all the levels that are colored blue over here, and you're right here at the touching between these pairs of bands. And so if you look at the low energy excitations in graphene, you find that this is what the energy momentum dispersion looks like. It's not the familiar quadratic dispersion that we're used to for a particle with some effective mass. Instead, this looks like a massless particle. It propagates with a fixed velocity. If this was an elementary particle, we would say that this is the velocity of light. Here, of course, the velocity is a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than the velocity of light. It's the effective velocity of this medium. And it obeys essentially the Dirac equation in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions for a particle that has no mass. Okay, so the building block of our twisted bilayer graphene system is already somewhat unusual. Okay, so already you have something that is qualitatively new appearing in this band structure. The low energy excitations are really Dirac fermions, okay, which are massless Dirac fermions. Okay, so now let's take this ingredient and put it together with this a pair of layers that we're going to twist relative to one another. And before I go there, there's just one technical point that's going to keep reappearing, which is you see that there are multiple cones over here that touch between the two bands. Okay, and these are called valleys. And in many situations, like the one we'll talk about, if your electron lives in one particular valley, it's very unlikely it's going to get to the other valley. Okay, it's a very large momentum transfer. Typically, you don't have those kind of scatterings. So these end up being conserved quantum numbers. Okay, so you can think of this a bit like spin. We also have the spin of the electron, which is another degree of freedom. We'll have both spin and valley. Okay, it may look like there are six different valley indices over here. But it turns out because of the periodicity of this Brillouin zone, there are only two distinct points. So we'll have two valleys and two spins. So electrons you can think of as having four flavors, very much like the generations of elementary particles that you have in the standard model, except that these will all be degenerate. They'll all have the same properties to a large extent. And they'll be described by these massless Dirac fermions. Okay, so now what happens when we combine a pair of these sheets we twist them and we end up getting this Mourier pattern that the electrons will also see. Okay, so that is the problem before us. And in fact, this was, people looked at this a couple of decades back, actually even more than that. And they figured out something very interesting that would happen in the band structure of this of these two layers of graphene. Okay, so the way in which the electrons see this Mourier pattern, so this is the pattern shown at a slightly more realistic scale. So we're going to be talking about small twist angles of order 1 degree. I'll explain in a second why we are interested in that particular angle. But at this small angle, the size of this periodic Mourier pattern that you get is large compared to the interatomic spacing. Okay, so you can barely see the interatomic spacing over here. And this is the effective size that we are talking about. In fact, this angle, if you express it in radians, it's about a 60th of a radian, 1 degree, right? And that's really the small parameter in our problem. That's what makes the effective Moivre scale so much larger than the atomic scale. And what we'll be talking about is really electrons moving through this periodic potential. Yeah, and so ultimately, the fate of this entire system will actually relate to the small density of electrons, which are either filling or emptying these sites.
Oops, did you just lose me?
I did. I wasn't sure if it was my connection or yours.
No, it was me. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. I'm not very sure where I left off, but
I just lost you for a few seconds then.
Okay. Good. Yeah. I was probably repeating myself anyway. So. So let me tell you what's special about this this 1 degree angle. So if you think about electrons moving through this these pair of sheets. You can compare two timescales, if you like. One of the timescales is really to go between, to go from one Moivre site to the next. There's a typical velocity to the electrons. It takes some time to go between the Moivre sites. And the other timescale is the time it takes to tunnel between the two sheets. And when those two timescales become comparable, that's when interesting things begin to happen to your band structure. And turns out that happens roughly at this angle of about 1 degree, or in terms of radians, this 1/160th of a radian. Okay, and so let's see exactly what happens. So the way to do that is to literally take this massive massless Dirac particles and expose them to this Moivre potential. Okay, and the way in which it works, I won't go into too much detail over here, except to point out one thing, which is now since a couple of things. One is that since the size of this lattice is bigger than the original lattice, if I go to Fourier space, the momentum space, correspondingly the Brillouin zone, the range over which the momenta occur gets shrunk. Okay, so we're going to be talking about momenta that live within the smaller Brillouin zone. Okay, so that's one point. The other point is that the way the electrons see this lattice, this Moivre lattice is kind of interesting. It really occurs through this tunneling between the layers. Okay, so each of these are just the Dirac Hamiltonians and they get coupled to each other. The two layer Dirac Hamiltonians get coupled to each other because electrons go between the two layers. And you can rewrite this, or you can expand out this tunneling term. And this is one of the things I wanted to point out. You find that it has two pieces to it. Okay, the two pieces ultimately arise because of the Dirac structure of this of particles in this problem. There are two parameters that tell us how well this particle tunnels between the two layers. And it's really the ratio of this parameter, that is going to be important to us. So we're going to be talking about the ratio of electrons tunneling in two different parts of this Moivre lattice. Okay, so if you look at the lattice, this is a kind of a zoom in on a small segment of it. There are some regions where the carbon atoms of the two layers sit right on top of each other. They're called the AA regions. So this first tunneling over here refers to electrons tunneling in that region. Okay, but there's another part of the lattice where the electrons tunnel between opposite sublattices. So one atom of one layer is above a different atom of the lower layer, but the other atoms are not sitting on top of each other. Okay, so it's like a half stacked over here. And actually carbon likes this kind of stacking. It's called Bernal stacking. And that refers to the second coupling over here, W1. So when people did this, the first models of this twisted bilayer, they set both of these tunnelings to each other, equal to each other. It's kind of to be democratic. You assume there's no bias. But what people have found increasingly is that since graphene likes this type of region, these tunnelings tend to increase. You get more of the sample ends up becoming of that type, and it reduces at the expense of tunneling in this AA type region. Okay, so this this quantity, the ratio has decreased from 1 to 0.7 as far as models go. And it turns out this is important to understand aspects of the band structure of bilayer graphene. Okay, and we'll come back to this when we talk more about the band structure. Okay, so you you incorporate these features and you can calculate what the electronic states look like in magic angle group in this small angle graphene. And it looks something like this. It looks like a pair of, so we said we had two valleys. So let's look at one particular valley. You have the energy, and this is the remnant of these drug cones that we had. So now they get separated out. Yeah, sorry for that. So it's the thing that we're going to be most interested in is going to be these electronic states that are close to charge neutrality. Can you see that they're extremely flat? And the entire phenomenology that we'll be talking about will be, you know, what happens when you sweep your chemical potential or you sweep your the filling of electrons through these electronic states. Okay, the first thing that should strike you is how extremely flat these states are. So there's hardly any dispersion. There's hardly any difference in energy for all of these states, despite the fact that they have very different crystal momentum. Okay, so so this signals you know, a regime where the interaction between electrons will be very important. So when theorists first noticed this, they noticed that as they change the angle, there's a particular set of angles where the band becomes extremely flat. They said, look, this is a good place to do experiments, and you know, interaction between electrons is going to be important. But of course, they could not predict exactly what would happen. Okay, so besides saying that, you know, it's a good regime to think about, you know, to explore. Okay, and that's where the experimentalists came in. You know, notably the group of Pablo, and what they showed is that they could, you know, do these measurements by changing the chemical potential. You know, going through these nearly flat bands, they could monitor what is happening to their sample. And they saw this these remarkable effects. Of course, there are two limits where things are very simple. If they were to completely empty out all the electrons from these bands or completely fill them, they simply saw an insulator. And that corresponds to the red over here, the high resistance. But in between, when they were filling in different numbers of electrons into the sample, they saw some various features. They saw certain insulators at you know, corresponding to an integer number of electrons for each of these Moray sites. So for some you know, fraction of this band being filled. But probably most amazingly, they saw superconductivity. That's the light blue over here. A regime of electron filling where the resistivity dropped all the way down to zero. Okay, and this was completely unexpected. And of course, it you know, it started off a lot of activity. And at least to us, the main questions at this point was, you know, there are three ingredients over here. You have these electronic bands that look very unusual. You have these insulating states that appear at certain fillings, and then you have the superconductivity. And are these things related to one another, or are they just three different phenomena that happen to collide in this particular system? And so over the last couple of years, I think we have been able to you know, sort of show, give evidence that these three aspects are all connected to one another. Okay, at least there's one way of thinking where within which you can show in a particular limit that it's literally the novel features of the electronic bands, the qualitatively new features of the electronic bands are directly related both to the insulating states that you see as well as the superconductivity. And all three together, they form they could form a coherent story. And based on that, you know, you can also try to go ahead and make predictions where else you could see this kind of physics. Okay, you think you really understand the physics, you should be able to make those type of predictions. Okay, and one of the things we noticed very early on, which is kind of a special feature of these systems, is that the total number of electrons you need to put in to go from completely empty to completely full is actually 8 electrons. Okay, so things are roughly symmetric around zero. They're not perfectly symmetric. That's the charge neutrality point. That's the natural filling of graphene. You can either fill below or you know, empty out electrons or add them. And you need to add 4 or subtract 4 if you want to get to the balance layers. Okay, and that turns out to be a special feature of this band structure that you know, even when you take into account the degeneracies that I mentioned before, spin and valley, there's like a doubling of the bands. Okay, you have this factor of 8 rather than a factor of 4. That, you know, as we go along, we'll see that that is one of the special features that's rather unique to this particular system of twisted bilayer graphene. Okay, so maybe I can pause here for a second if there are any questions. I don't think I heard any during my, while I was speaking, but you know, people should feel free to ask. Okay, so so one of the things that gives you quite a bit of insight into this model is that we said we have this parameter that we could manipulate the ratio of the tunneling between the two regions of the of graphene. And this parameter can be tuned. There's a natural value that people believe exists in these systems, but you can also choose to tune it to a different value that is that might give you more theoretical insight. And this turned out to be a very useful thing to do. Okay, so we tuned this particular parameter. In fact, we just switched off this particular coupling and we ended up with a model with slightly more symmetry. It's called the chiral model. It has a particular matrix that anti-commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, and this matrix is nothing but the two of the sites in the honeycomb lattice being labeled with eigenvalues plus and minus 1. Okay, so as any theoretical physicist knows, if you have more symmetry, you can often make progress. And we took that point of view. And of course, at the end of the day, we're going to try and restore just the physical symmetry that we actually have. But something interesting happens when you're in this chiral limit. So we went and plotted the band structure of these electrons as a function of the angle, but just retaining this the tunneling between the AB sites. Okay, so you see that initially we are at a rather large angle. So I'm going to represent this in terms of the inverse of the angle. So when this parameter is large, is small, it just means that the angle is very large. So you see that as I change the angle and I get to some particular angle, which is essentially 1 degree, you get this very, very flat band. And then you continue within this chiral model, you get dispersion, things are, you know, things have velocities and just, you know, changes of energy until you get to what's essentially the second magic angle. Again, it becomes perfectly flat and then it keeps going. Okay. In fact, you find an infinite sequence of magic angles within this model where you have switched off one of these tunnelings. Okay, so the main interesting features of this model that I could, you know, talk a lot more about. But one of the things that was, you know, very interesting to us was in the original band structure, you know, you had these very flat bands. But if you really go inside and go and inspect the bands, they're not perfectly flat. Okay, there's a little bit of dispersion. But what happens when you switch off these tunnelings, you go to the chiral model, the bands become perfectly flat. Okay, you can show that they're mathematically flat at a particular angle. And you can even find the wave functions of these bands analytically. Okay, and it turns out there are interesting connections to the quantum Hall effect that I may mention as we go along. Okay, but at this point, what we'd like to do is to take our insights into this of this model, which has this perfectly flat band, So now if I add electrons to that band, they really don't know which levels to fill. They have no guidance from the kinetic energy. And really it's the interactions that are going to split that degeneracy and organize the electrons into states that that are optimal as far as the repulsion is concerned. Okay, so this will be the part that will be really of interest, which is what happens when we include the interactions between electrons. Okay, so so one of the features that we found in this for this mathematically flat bands, these very these things that we saw in the previous video, is that since you have very flat flat bands, you can choose which bases to represent them. So in other words, you can take linear combinations of these bands, and it turns out there is one combination which is you know, you can anticipate will be good for interactions, which is to really see which combinations will keep the electrons on different sides of the lattice. And so you make those combinations, they're called sublattice polarized combinations. So the sublattice refer to this, the two sides that you have on the original graphene lattice. And when you do that, you find something very unusual. You find that these bands that are organized in this fashion actually carry Chern number. Okay, so this is precisely the quantity we mentioned before, that there is a topology associated with bands. It's a little bit hidden in this particular problem. It only reveals itself when you pick this particular basis. Okay, when you say, I would really want bands that are sitting on one sublattice or the other, because I anticipate that repulsion will favor those that basis. Okay, so when you do this decomposition, you find that your model actually looks a lot like the quantum Hall problem we had before. Okay, so you have two species, if you like. You have it's like you had a quantum Hall problem with Chern number one and a quantum Hall problem with Chern number minus one. So these two had to be present because you have time reversal symmetry in this problem. But within each sector, if you inspect each sector, there is a degeneracy. You've got to pick the valley, you've got to pick the spin, and you have to fill some fraction of these levels in order to be somewhere inside this range of filling where people see interesting things. Okay, so you ultimately reduce the problem that you had before to one in which you've got to select particular states, all of which have a quantum Hall type of character. Okay, and so this refers, this ended up referring to earlier work that people have done in the context of the quantum Hall effect. You don't simply just fill a band, you also make a choice whether you fill spin up or spin down, and then you choose a subset of those energy levels and form an insulating state. Okay, so so one of the very interesting things that emerges over there, which I'll get to in the next few minutes, is that by this chain of logic, you end up also identifying a particular mechanism of superconductivity that could occur in these systems. Okay, so people had thought about these type of mechanisms for superconductivity going back a few years. In fact, there's a nice paper by Parameter P.I. Chong Wang also about related phenomena. But what we'd like to do is to take that idea and really see if it can be implemented in a realistic context. And what makes superconductivity special, of course, in solid state systems is that you have this pairing of electrons. Okay, you have electrons that have the same electric charge getting together and pairing, which is really the mystery of superconductivity. How do you get things that are naturally repelling each other to get together and form a Cooper pair? Okay, and usually you invoke something else. You invoke something like phonons to do this pairing for you. But you'll see that here, because of the topology of the bands, there's a different route that is open to you. Okay, and potentially that may be what is going on in these systems. Okay, so to explain that, I need to say a little bit more about our description of the insulating state. And really it has to do with the setup where you have to pick a pair of these bands and fill them completely in order to get an insulator at one of these integer fillings. Okay, so I've picked picked one of the integers where I said there's an insulating phase. And it's really a form of ferromagnetism, if you like. So if you think of these as some kind of spins, spin up and spin down, we call it pseudo spin. It's like you polarize all the electrons in one particular pseudo spin. And similarly, you do the same thing over here in this other churn sector. And of course, like any other ferromagnet, you can describe this, the theory of such ordering can be described by a sigma model, a theory of a vector that is pointing along some direction. Okay, but then you can ask, is there something new that appears because the bands that we are starting with are actually topological? Okay, can the sigma model have some additional feature that is not present in regular magnets, your fridge magnet, for example, but that is present over here? And in fact, there is such a phenomenon. And it was identified, again, in the simpler context of the quantum Hall effect. And let me just briefly describe it in that context. So there we are, we're going back to this slide where von Klitzing found a quantized Hall state at this filling, let's say, of one electron per magnetic flux quantum. So it's the Hall conductance of one. But if you think about it, there was some choice that was being made over there. Okay, so you have electrons, there is a band, which is essentially the Landau level. You have electrons filling that band completely, but the electrons could either be spin up or spin down. Okay, so they make a choice, they pick one of the one of the projections of spin, and they really do that to lower the Coulomb repulsion. Okay, so very much like in atoms where you have the Hund's rule, where you like to keep all of the spins parallel, something very similar happens in these Landau levels. All the electrons point in the same direction and give you a ferromagnet. Okay, but in this context as well, one could ask, is there something special about the ferromagnet? For example, if I were to add an electron to this problem, how does the electron go in if I add electric charge? And the usual answer would be, there is a higher energy state, there's an excited state that corresponds to all the opposite spin electrons, the down electrons. You simply go and add an electron into that band. Okay, so this turns out to be incorrect, and there was the big surprise in this problem. It turns out there's a different way in which you can add the electron, which is completely counterintuitive if you've never seen this before, which is that you can the electric charge can go in the form of a skirmion. Okay, so instead of having all of the electronic spins pointing up, what could happen is that you could develop a texture of the electronic spins. So it could be up in the far away, but as you approach the center, the spin tumbles and it's pointing down. And you can form this texture in two dimensions. And it turns out this texture actually carries electric charge. And the way you can sort of rationalize that is because electrons moving in this texture see a Betty's phase, just the rotation of their spins. And in the quantum Hall effect, any kind of Betty's phase, whether it's coming from the magnetic field, the Arnau-Bohm effect, or this kind of Betty's phase, all of those are associated with electric charge. Okay, so this texture ends up sucking in one electric charge, one unit of electric charge. And then the question becomes, which is the lower energy excitation? Is it better for me to make this texture when I add a charge? Or is it better for me just to climb this energy gap and go and put an electron in the opposite spin? And it turns out remarkably in the quantum Hall effect, where everything works out beautifully, the energy of the skirmion is actually half that of the gap for the single particle excitations. Okay, so in fact, the lowest energy excitation is this highly unlikely possibility that you actually tumble all the spins and put in the electronic charge like that. Okay, and people can see that in experiment. I won't go into the details, but essentially what they see is that when electric charge is added to the quantum Hall effect, the magnetization drops very rapidly because you start getting these kind of textures. And you can compare that to theory, and it all seems to work out. Okay, so this is kind of interesting for us because we have a very similar setup. Okay, so we have also a churn band with electrons that are forced to choose a spin direction. And one of the very fundamentally interesting things that appears over here is that this sort of changes the order of what we think of as being underlying degree of freedom and what is an emergent degree of freedom. Okay, so we often have this prejudice that it's very easy to figure out what is made up of what. So for example, in a ferromagnet, we would say the ferromagnet is really built of electrons. It's all the electronic spins being ordered that gives us the ferromagnet. But here you have the kind of the reverse situation occurring. It's like you can think of the spins of the ferromagnet as being fundamental, and the texture, that's the emergent particle, that turns out to be the electron. Okay, so it's just, I feel it's nice to keep in mind that sometimes these, the relation between what is the underlying degree of freedom and what is emergent can be, can be less obvious. And a very similar kind of physics appeared in theories due to Tully Scum, who talked about how you could get baryons from essentially a sigma model for mesons. So that the baryons were the analog of our electrons, and the analog of the ferromagnet was the meson condensate. And actually, this paper is a very nice paper about this theory. So one of the things I found interesting about it was he has this little note. Well, first of all, he had a very adventurous life, as you can see from his affiliations. But he also had this note about, I guess, a high school student who came and helped him with the calculations. And I think there's a typo, but that's actually Tony Leggett, if I'm not mistaken, who went and spent, he's a Nobel laureate for his work on helium, liquid helium. So the next time you get an email from a high school or a undergraduate student, maybe you should think about Tony Scott. Okay, so now let's get back to our problem, which is the analog of this quantum Hall ferromagnet, but now with two flavors, and I won't go into the details, but essentially this the same mechanism where the skirmions are really the charge carriers allows you to come up with a mechanism for superconductivity. Okay, so if you start with your insulator and you dope charge, you add electronic charge, instead of going in as single electrons, which is one option, there's a different option, which is that it goes in as skirmions. And because you have two sectors which have this opposite Chern number, it ends up that these two sectors couple to each other, and they can form Cooper pairs. And we can do a simple calculation for a model that just has these Cooper pair degrees of freedom. And you could figure out what happens in the setting. Okay, and to kind of cut a long story short, you can predict what the transition temperature of this superconductor is, where the electronic charge is going in as a topological defect. And this gives you a scale that is roughly consistent with what is seen in the experiments. Okay, so I can come back to this later if there are questions, since I'm almost out of time, let me mention one thing that allowed us to do. Okay, so there's a simple physical way of thinking about how these skirmions combine together to give you a Cooper pair, but again, I'll defer it. But all of this, what it allowed us to do was to identify something essential, what we thought of as being essential ingredients for superconductivity. And one of the things that appears is that there's a certain symmetry that allows you to have a certain configuration of these energy levels. And it turns out that symmetry in our theory is important, or at least it helps to get the pairing of these skirmions. Okay, so we thought to ourselves, if you had to really try to prove this theory, it's going to be very hard, of course. It's hard to prove theories of that assign an origin for something like superconductivity. Of course, you could try to calculate as many things as possible and try to compare that with experiments. But many of the fundamental parameters of the experiment are relatively unknown. So instead, the task we set ourselves is, let's try to identify what we think is really essential features here. And using that, we could see if there are other platforms that have not been studied yet, which may have a chance to realize superconductivity. And one of the things we identified, one of these ingredients, it turns out very few Moray materials actually have it, apart from magic angle graphene. Okay, so after the discovery of magic angle graphene, there's a whole industry, people trying different pairs of materials, twisting them and looking for what happens. Very few of them actually showed superconductivity, and we feel it may be because this particular ingredient is missing. Okay, but there's one other configuration that gives you, that allows you to retain this ingredient, which actually came, was thought of by my by our postdoc, Islam Khalaf. He had earlier come up with this structure where you have alternating twist layers. Okay, you take a layer of graphene, you twist the next layer, and then the third one is twisted back. You can do the same for four layers, you know, twisted back and forth. And it turns out all of these have the requisite symmetry, but they also seem to have magic angles. Okay, so if these are the magic angles I talked about for two-layer graphene bilayer, it turns out these multi-layer systems also have magic angles. And there's a simple relation between the two magic angles. So for example, this one over here for trilayer is simply square root of 2 times bigger than what it was for the bilayer. So the prediction would be go take the trilayer, do the alternating twist, go to 1.55 degrees, and there should be superconductivity. Okay, that was what our the simple-minded interpretation of our theory was. You could also do four layers. You do the alternating twist, and here it's kind of interesting. The new magic angle is actually the golden ratio times the original two-layer magic angle. Okay, nobody has done this yet, but that would be another prediction that the four-layer would also be, should also be a superconductor. By the same, just by looking at the ingredients that are going in. Okay, so so we you know, talked to some experimentalists. We were not very hopeful that they would listen to us because there's a long tradition in condensed matter physics of people, you know, not really believing theoretical guidance to find superconductors, because this famously encompassed in these rules due to Bernd Matthias. He came up with a rule, you know, he found many superconductors. He came up with these rules for how to find ITC superconductors. Okay, it's back in the day, of course. So his rules 1 to 5, stay away from oxygen, stay away from magnetism, all of those rules are actually violated by the cuprate superconductors. Okay, so of course, those were not very, you know, not really believed anymore, I would say. But rule number 6 was, people thought that that was really like, you know, he was really onto something there. So, you know, generally experimentalists, I think, don't believe these predictions. But, you know, fortunately, we found two groups who were, you know, maybe they didn't know about this. they didn't know about these rules. So Philip and Pablo, and, you know, they set about looking at these trial layers. And maybe they had their own reasons as well. But I think maybe we gave them a bit more impetus. And in fact, earlier this year, or late last year, they both published these very nice papers where they saw robust superconductivity. In fact, it's even better than in the bilayer, slightly better than in the bilayer, with very interesting properties that can be tuned with an electric field. So that's a new knob that you get. You can tune the electric field perpendicular to the layers, and you can switch on and switch off the superconductivity. Okay, so I won't have time to get into this, but it really did seem that these trilayers are at least as good, if not better in some ways than the bilayer superconductors. Okay, so I'll probably end over here. So I try to sketch some mechanism for superconductivity, but there are many questions, I should say, that you know, we are able to work the theory in a limit that is rather ideal. And we really need numerics or, you know, some other ways of trying to get towards the more realistic limit, and from the experimental side to also learn more about the parameters that we should be looking at. Okay, and there are analogs of this theory, which are, you know, essentially have the same ingredients, have many of the same ingredients, but could be adapted more to a metallic phase. That's another thing that we are thinking about. And let me end with my most important slide. So we have many collaborators. So we had a nice collaboration with Mike Zalatel's group at Berkeley, and also my collaborators at Harvard, especially Islam and Patrick, about some of these trilayer things. And we also had important collaborations with experimental groups. So let me stop over here and take any questions, or, you know, I'd be happy to elaborate about things that I skipped over.
Okay, so yeah, please feel free to unmute or show your and clap or show your appreciation some other way for that excellent talk. Can I start by asking if there are any questions from students? Any students in the audience with a question? Are there any questions from non-students? I had a question just to start off. So this prediction of the magic angle is root 2 times in the trilayer system times the bilayer angle or the golden ratio, and is that calculated in this simplified chiral theory that you talked about earlier, or something analogous to that?
Yeah.
Where you only.
Yeah. So it's. This figure that I showed is done in the chiral theory. Then we, of course, all these things, we actually go back and put in the realistic parameters. And at least this first magic angle doesn't change much. So it's pretty robust to putting back all the imperfections of the realistic band structure. Mm-hmm. The higher magic angles are more sensitive to putting in those imperfections. So sometimes you see that it's very flat, but then you get a dispersion when you put on the other coupling, the W naught. So all of these other angles, these lower angle magic angles, they are more delicate. But somehow, for reasons we don't quite understand, the first magic angle is extremely robust to putting on these other perturbations, which are not that small actually.
And do you have a reason to? Did you expect the superconductivity to be stronger in the trilayer system, and do you expect it to be even stronger with more layers, or was that a surprise?
That's a good question. So, you know, there are arguments both ways, so we weren't very sure. So one simple argument is because the angle is larger, the electrons are all closer to one another. So the lattice is now drawn in because the angle is larger. And ultimately, we are talking about some physics coming from electron-electron interaction. So if you crank up the interaction, you would expect the TC would go up. Ultimately, that's what sets the scale. But on the other hand, it turns out there is something additional in this problem that I didn't really highlight, which is that there is this, in addition to this flat band in the trilayer, there is this Dirac cone. So there is a coexisting Dirac cone along with the flat band. For most purposes, they don't talk to each other because they're so different. One is completely flat, the other is dispersing so quickly. But that gives you some degree of screening, the additional electrons. So they tend to reduce the interaction between the electrons. So then it becomes a quantitative thing, which one is the bigger effect. But I think the fact that they see more robust conductivity may also be a materials issue. Because it's a larger angle, it's somehow easier to make, and they have less disorder, they have less floating of this of the angle, you know, in different parts of the sample, which is kind of a problem for the bilayer case. The bigger angle just helps them. I think that may ultimately be the most important effect.
Okay, thanks. Are there any other questions that have cropped up? If not, I guess in view of the time, you packed in so much great physics to the talk that we're all stunned and digesting. It's like after a big delicious meal. So let's thank Ashvin one more time for an excellent talk.